welcome to the Miko Bits Show. And I'm your host, Miko Bits. Today, we have Justin Rice from the Stellar Development Foundation, which is a nonprofit and ecosystem for Stellar blockchain. So very excited to have Justin join us. Interested to hear all of the latest and greatest from the Stellar blockchain and, of course, learn about the growth of this ecosystem. So I guess without further ado, the first thing I always like to say is, you know, we do talk about purchasable cryptographic assets on the show, but it is a entertainment show. So this is not investment advice. So you should seek a licensed professional if you want investment advice. So without further ado, here's Justin. Great to have you.
Hi, great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's start a little bit with yourself. So, you know, first of all, just tell us, what your role is in Stellar, and then, describe your responsibilities, and then a little bit about how you got connected with that.
So I work for the Stellar Development Foundation, which is, as you mentioned, a nonprofit corporation, and we seek to support and grow the Stellar network. Our goal is to create equitable access to the world's financial infrastructure. And to do that, we essentially help projects and partners take advantage of the Stellar network to build things that sort of reach out into the world and solve problems, reduce friction, and make it easier to sort of transact across borders specifically in order to build better products and reach new markets. As the head of ecosystem, my team is involved in helping those projects. And so we do a lot of different things. We work with businesses to help them optimize their use of Stellar, to connect with one another, and to launch products that they built on Stellar. And we also work with developers to create resources so that people can understand how to use Stellar. And that includes things like the documentation that we work on all the time, and hackathons and university outreach. And so we sort of help people, businesses, and also educate and help developers so that it's easy to build on Stellar for any project that can use Stellar as rails to sort of connect to the financial world.
Got it. And how big is the Stellar Development Foundation in terms of people? And also, if you can say, if there's an asset base to the foundation?
The Stellar Development Foundation has about 80 people now who are either full-time employees or contractors, and they're spread across the globe.
Wow.
We've grown a lot over the past year and a half or so, and a lot of that growth has been because the ecosystem itself has grown and demanded more attention. That's what the foundation is. What was the other question?
Oh, the other question is, is there, like with many foundations, there's, often some kind of an asset base, or there's a bunch of Stellar there, or I'm just wondering if there's if it's that kind of a foundation. Is it an endowed foundation? Is there?
Oh, yeah, right. I got it. Stellar is interesting. It's not a proof of work system. There is a native network token called the Lumen, or XLM. Lumens were all created on day one, or sort of ledger one of the network. And the SDF, part of our goal is to distribute those Lumens in a way that supports the network. And so our endowment comes from those Lumens, but the majority of those Lumens are actually spoken for and are used for other purposes. And incidentally, if you ever want to see where the Lumens are or what we're doing with them, we're very transparent about what their intended purpose is and how we're spending them. We have a page that's, I guess, on stellar.org/foundation/mandate that will sort of lay out our mandate and the Lumen allocations. And you can actually see, as we distribute those Lumens for specific purposes, where they're going and what they're doing.
That's great. I'm what I like to call a self-professed open source financial infrastructure maximalist. And, because of that, I'm very aligned to what you described as equitable access to the world's financial infrastructure. I guess if I got that right, I'd love to kind of have you unpack that, a little bit further, right? Which is, that's sort of the broadly stated mission. So I'd love to understand that. It sounds like when you talk about access to the infrastructure, in a way, the access element, you know, obviously you're providing your own infrastructure, but there may also be other forms of infrastructure as well. You know, things like centralized infrastructure, traditional infrastructure. So how do you see this? And you know, maybe some project examples would be super interesting.
Sure. So Stellar is a platform that connects all the world's currencies. Once a currency is tokenized and represented on the network infrastructure makes it really easy to, you know, hold, transfer, trade, and transmute any kind of currency. But Stellar is built so that essentially asset issuance is a first class representation on Stellar. An asset is a first class thing on Stellar. So in a few lines of code, anyone can come issue an asset on the network. And then there are also ecosystem standards that allow people to connect those on network assets to to assets outside the network. In other words, it's really easy to build an on-off ramp for a fiat currency that connects to Stellar. And so essentially what the Stellar model is that all these different organizations, we call them anchors, which are regulated financial institutions, they essentially accept consumer deposits on via traditional rails and digitize those, issue an asset on the Stellar network. And once it's on the network, the holder of that asset can take advantage of it to do these really cheap, fast, easy, and compliant cross-currency payments. So the infrastructure itself is great for that, but the connection that is sort of specified in these ecosystem standards allows the Stellar network to connect to other financial infrastructure. And again, traditionally that's banking rails, but you can also connect it to other cryptocurrency networks, or really to any asset in the real world. That you can redeem, that you can sort of deposit for an on-network asset and redeem in return for the asset that it represents.
Got it. You know, and I think from a historical perspective, you know, one of the things that I think is novel about XLM is that, you know, it shares, you know, a founder, Jeb McCaleb, with the XRP network. So I guess one of the things I'd love to have you sort of describe a little bit is, you know, this common heritage and, you know, what your thoughts are about, you know, the comparison, you know, and how did that happen?
Yeah, you know, Jed is a really interesting thinker, and I think that he first founded Ripple and ended up leaving Ripple to found Stellar with a lot of the same ideas in mind. You know, he wanted to help create infrastructure that could make things like cross-border and cross-currency payments really easy and could reduce a lot of the friction that exists in the current system. When he founded when he created Stellar, the network, he also founded the Stellar Development Foundation. And the idea behind that founding was that the SDF does not own or control the network. The network is open source, open participation. Anyone can run a validator. Anyone can transact on it without the permission of the SDF. And this idea of like a open permissionless network that was supported by a foundation is, I think, what differentiates Stellar in many ways from Ripple. I think Jed really wanted a world in which the supporting institution did not, like the relationship between the network and the supporting institution was a little bit different. The supporting institution has no vested interest in the network itself, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it makes sense. So, you know, I think from that perspective, one of the interesting challenges faced by the XRP community through regulators is maybe a little bit less pressure because of the, you know, unique position of the foundation. So, you know, that may be a pretty material difference, if I hear you correctly.
Yeah, it could be. I mean, I think that the general idea is that, you know, Stellar should be the internet for payments, and, you know, the internet is not owned by anyone. It makes sense for it to be open access and to be supported, but for anyone to be able to participate without there being a gatekeeper.
Yeah, that's a good way of thinking about it. And you know, I'm definitely you know, internet infrastructure maxi. So I think that's for sure a good way of thinking. So what I'd love to do is dip into projects. So, you know, you're an ecosystem person, you know, so it's all about developers and projects. So, you know, would love to get some cool projects. So, you know, maybe if you have some projects that you're excited by or things that you really like, you know, would love to get a shout out, or, you know, would love to hear about these.
Yeah, I mean, I think the biggest news that the biggest project that has launched on Stellar recently, and I'm talking about in the past few months, is that USDC, which originated as an Ethereum-only asset, is now launched on Stellar. And there are a lot of advantages to USDC existing across chains. I think the Stellar implementation, the Stellar-issued USDC, is really good for payments because Stellar is fast and cheap. It scales well. And so for people who are interested in using a really reliable US dollar asset, but using it for, not for smart contract execution, but really for payments, it opens up a whole new world because USDC is not only backed by a reliable organization, but they have monthly attestations as to their reserves. It's just like this super consumer friendly and trustworthy asset. And so the USDC launch on Stellar is really big, and it's really helping a lot of the people who are building cross-currency systems or who have other assets who want to facilitate cross-border payments. It's allowing them to access this asset that is just like super strong. So USDC is a big one. There are other examples of other, again, we call them anchors, these on-off ramps that issue an asset on the network that you can redeem for the real world fiat currency that underlies it. There are all these different corridors that are being built between different anchors, different institutions that offer those assets. And one exciting one, for instance, is in Europe, there's a company called Tempo. They issue a euro asset, and they have been interacting with a lot of different remittance corridors. So they're working with some Latin American countries and some African countries where people can basically use the euro asset to remit payments back to where they belong. So Tempo is a sort of remittance corridor or remittance provider in Europe, and they use Stellar to basically to be able to make these remittance payments almost instantaneously to various origin countries. I'd say in addition to that, there are also great apps that are built on Stellar, because in addition to building a corridor between anchors, you can also create an app that gives an individual user access to the assets on the network. And that app can interoperate with the providers of these on-off ramps. And so a great example of this is an app called Vibrant. Vibrant is a wallet that's for Argentinians, and it's basically a US dollar savings app. So they can deposit via a local on-ramp, their ARS, and convert it to a USD balance, which they can hold. And then as they need to make payments in daily life, they can just convert small amounts to sort of make those actual payments. And so those are kind of examples. There's USDC specifically. There are these remittance corridors set up between anchors. And then there are apps like Vibrant that take advantage of an anchor to on-ramp someone and give them access to the whole world of assets that are on the Stellar platform.
Yeah, interesting, right? So it sounds like from a platform perspective, then the killer applications are things like international remittance and, thinking about this in terms of corridors and country pairs. Interested to kind of get a feeling about, what your specific activities are, with the foundation. Obviously, you have a lot of developers, so it sounds like you're doing a lot of really good developer support type functions. Do you do grant functions, or what other types of things do you do as a foundation?
Yes, as I mentioned at the top, there is a page where you can actually see all of the different grant buckets that we have and all
Great.
the different Lumen allocations. And there are these really specific purposes that each one is tuned to. And I'll just say, like, each one, we're very explicit about the goals and about the rationale that we have behind each distribution, about who qualifies. And we're pretty public about who we allocate those funds to. The specific kind of grant buckets that I think about a lot are, first, there are infrastructure grants. So people who create in the ecosystem, who create vital infrastructure that's necessary to build on Stellar, including, like, there's a bunch of Stellar SDKs, the Stellar Network Explorer, the Stellar Block Explorer, these kinds of projects that provide necessary utility. We give them infrastructure grants. There's also the Stellar Community Fund, which actually the first the nomination round, like there's one going on right now, which is called the Seed Fund, and it attempts to give some sort of startup capital to new businesses that are building on Stellar. The Community Fund is interesting in that anyone can apply. There are specific requirements for each round of applications, And the ultimate distribution of those funds isn't determined solely by SDF. It's determined by a panel of community members. So community funds is for new projects. Infrastructure grants is for infrastructure. There's also a series of currency grants. As I mentioned, anchors are these financial institutions, regulated financial institutions that build on off ramps. And there's a whole grant program that helps them integrate with Stellar so that they can do that better. And then finally, there's also an enterprise fund, which isn't a grant. It is basically, there's a sort of investment fund that the SDF manages where we find projects that are building on Stellar and help them to grow by making a meaningful investment in that project.
Nice. And presumably investment in the form of Stellar.
In the form of Lumens, yeah.
Yeah, makes sense.
Yeah, yeah. Just to be clear, I don't mean to pick nits, but the native network currency is called the Lumen.
Yep. No, absolutely. It's good to keep those things straight. So So I guess what I'd love to kind of understand is, kind of what are the novel characteristics? I mean, it sounds like there's a payment optimization, right? So, it sounds like some of the optimization has to do with speed, and it has to do with things like, fees. So, maybe you can kind of describe a little bit about those, what makes you distinct, and, get into some of the detail there.
So Stellar is designed for asset issuance. So you can issue an asset just with a few lines of code. An asset is essentially just something, it represents it on the network, it's created by an account. There's no smart contracting required, right? So you can just create an account and issue an asset. The fact that you can issue assets really easily is part of the design, because the idea again is that anyone, including people, these regulated financial institutions, can issue assets that represent something in the real world. And once that happens, all those assets can be transferred from any, held by any account, transferred to any account. There's also accounts not only track ownership, but they also track what you want to do with what you own. So you can basically put bids and asks in. You can say, I want to sell euros for dollars or buy euros with dollars. And the ledger actually tracks those bids and asks. And there's a built-in decentralized exchange so that when bids and asks meet, trades are automatically executed. So asset issuance and a built-in decentralized exchange. Third, I would say, again, I sort of mentioned that there are these interoperability standards that make it easy to connect existing infrastructure to Stellar. And those allow various participants in the network to transact, but also to sort of check compliance so they can pass information like know your customer information, things that are required based on jurisdictional requirements. And so the ability to sort of transact in a compliant manner is also part of it. And then finally, I'd say interoperability, because there are all these assets and there's a built-in exchange and there are these standards that allow people to transact compliantly. It's really easy for almost, for any asset, anyone to sort of plug into the network and easily interoperate with anyone else who's using the network. And again, as you mentioned, all of that sort of optimizes Stellar so that it's really well primed for cross-border and cross-asset payments. I guess finally, in addition to that, you sort of touched on these things, is that Stellar has a consensus protocol that does not rely on proof of work. Instead, it relies on basically a series of votes between validators, and it is quite fast. A ledger closes in 3 to 5 seconds with finality. And it's also, because there's no mining, it's also quite cheap. So it's fast and it's cheap, and there's sort of instant transaction finality.
Yeah, interesting. So without mining, like, how does the network get incentivized? Is it just purely the transactional basis? Like,
There is no financial incentive to run a Stellar validator at all.
Okay.
The reasons why people run a validator are basically, so also validators on Stellar are not anonymous. When you put up a validator, you essentially self-identify it so that an organization that's running a validator is known on the network. So, if say Lobster, which is a Stellar wallet, runs a validator, everyone can look at it and say, there is Lobster's validator. And so the reasons that people end up running validators, it usually makes sense from a business perspective, right? So either they have a business that relies on Stellar and it makes sense for them to support the decentralized network, The costs of doing it are lower in many cases than trying to connect to some other rail. So it's sort of like there is a small cost, but the cost is sort of par for the course in terms of doing business, but supporting the network might be in their long-term interest. And then the other reason that people run a validator is because they essentially, as I mentioned, there's this idea of transaction finality. Like if you run a validating node, it essentially signs each transaction set. Like it joins in consensus. It verifies that the transactions are valid, and then it appends its signature, right? It's endorsing or ratifying each change to the ledger. If you're an issuer of an asset, that can be really, really important because you always know that you have agreed to the transactions that involve your asset. So if someone wants to redeem that asset off network, you are sort of looking at every ledger and confirming that you're okay with it. And so there's never a moment when you have to worry about some other version of the ledger being on the hook for some other sort of set of transactions that you don't approve.
Yeah, that makes sense. And obviously, it's a different topology, but it definitely makes a lot of sense for, these types of applications, and it seems like if you are involved in providing a service on top of the blockchain, you should probably be running nodes. So I guess a quick question for yourself, tell us a little bit about your background and how did you get involved in this?
I've had a lot of different, I've taken a lot of different steps to get here, and it was not the shortest route to blockchain. I worked for various startups, mostly as a freelancer for a long time, and then I was a professional musician for a long time. So I worked
Cool.
in music, I released records, I worked with bands, I recorded soundtracks, and the scene that I came up out of was very DIY, right? It was like you can make music. Just if you want to make music, just start making it. If you want to put out records, put them out yourself. If you want to put on shows, set them up, meet people, get out there, do what you love to do. Eventually, from that world, I ended up, people that I met there, a lot of them actually ended up in tech, and I think that sort of DIY attitude eventually does lead you to blockchain, right? This is a world where we're still making up the rules. We're still trying to figure out how the technology works. It requires a bit of scrappiness. And most of it, if you even think about like sort of how much of the sort of value that's created here is just done based on ingenuity and sort of elbow grease. There's actually quite a parallel between that DIY music world and this world of blockchain. For me specifically, I kind of got brought into it because I did know Jed for a long time. And I remember when he was first talking about Bitcoin, it seemed so crazy, but he always has interesting ideas. And I was intrigued enough to follow along. And so I think it was like that combination of the DIY ethos, plus knowing Jed, plus just like sort of the intellectual curiosity that he ignited in me about blockchain that eventually led me here.
Wow, that's super great. That's super good. I'm a general partner with a venture fund, Gumi Cryptos Capital, and my partner in Tokyo, who's basically started a publicly traded company called Gumi, comes from the music industry. Definitely had a first career in music, and then went on to, I guess, spawn six venture funds, and build out quite a really interesting set of companies in Japan. So, it's very cool, and I think blockchain is an incredibly cool space because it invites a lot of people from different, sections of the world. So, I guess one of the questions I love to ask people is kind of what's the big idea? I know it's a funny way of framing it, but I'm really interested to know kind of your vision. I mean, I know that you mentioned the mission of the foundation, but I'm sure that there's personal things in here for you. So I'd love to kind of get like how what makes you tick, and also sort of what's your big kind of multi-decade sort of vision about the future, and what's going to happen next.
I love the idea of, I did say that the foundation's goal is to provide or increase equitable access to the world's financial infrastructure. I got to say that does really resonate with me, the idea of equal or equitable access, right? It doesn't make sense to me intuitively or just philosophically that you're stuck where you're born, right? If you're born in a certain place with a certain currency, speaking a certain language, with certain access to certain things, I'm lucky that I happen to be born in the United States, that I sort of come from a position where I don't have to, I won the lottery, right? But it feels like a lottery that you have no control over where you're born.
Yeah.
And it just seems to me like the thing that the world needs is to eliminate the randomness of that lottery, to sort of give people a chance, to give people more access to better things, and to do it and to provide it in places where it's not readily available right now. So it's just this a world with no barriers to access, and it is what I hope for, and like getting there is what drives me every day. And it makes sense to start with money, right? Because for better or for worse, your sort of financial well-being, your material existence has a lot to do with what you can do on a given day. So eliminating barriers to access to financial infrastructure really does resonate with me. And I think that when I think about where blockchain can lead us, I do believe that's it, that there will be a world where the sort of privileged gatekeepers lose sway, and anyone who is ingenious and motivated can actually reach out and change the world. And they can do it because the impossible barriers, I'm not saying it will ever be easy for anyone, but like the impossible barriers will be removed. Possibility will open up and the world will really, really start to sing.
Nice. I like it. And it has this unification thing. I think when you look at music and the function it performs, it's definitely kind of a has kind of a way of crossing borders and a way of connecting people. And so I think the ethos is definitely there. I think for me, one of the things I like to think is that open source software is very much kind of irresistible, and in a sense open source has a patience because it's durable, and it's in a sense it's immortal, right? And so the it's it, because of that, and because it's driven by consent, it tends to lower the cost of participation, increase the rates of innovation, and it pushes it's hard to resist, right? So free software is hard to resist.
Yeah, I love what you said, that it has patience too. It's this sense that it's almost like an autonomous being, right? Like once you start to create something that is open source, it draws its own breath, right? And so it can outlast us all. Like if you start to build something meaningful that's open source, once you move on, whatever that means, other people can sort of always be picking it up and pushing it forward. And there's just this like inevitability and patience to open source that is really, really astounding. And I agree. There's a sense when you're working on it that you're working on something that will outlast us all.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the themes that we're sharing in common is are things like the idea of financial infrastructure, right? And I think the thing that is really subtle about what's happening from a macroeconomic perspective is that, we are moving towards a internet infrastructure, and we're moving towards an era that, I think will be more marked by consent. I mean, one of the things that I think is novel is the participation of traditional sovereigns, right? So one of the things we see happening in the news, for example, is that there are bans that are planned in India around, banning of cryptographic assets, including Bitcoin. So I guess what I'm wondering is, how you see state actors in this kind of worldview.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I mean, right now where we are, I feel like there's a lot of education that needs to happen. I think the goal right now, and this is definitely SDF's goal, is to try to work with regulators and legislators to help them understand the potential of this technology, to help them understand how to like we agree there need to be consumer safety protections, right? But there's a way to sort of create those without quashing innovation. And I think a big task for anyone in this entire industry is to try to help guide those discussions and provide education and have like meaningful input so that state actors are acting based on the best on like really legit information, right? So I believe that the goal should be to try to really help legislators and regulators understand the best, to chart the best path forward.
Yeah, makes sense. I mean, do you have any kind of a branch or any kind of mechanism within the foundation that sort of seeks to do that directly, or is it more just as a community we should all pick up individual efforts?
At SDF, we do have a policy team, and they're in, we have someone in Washington, boots on the ground, talking to everyone, in the previous administration and in this administration. We also work within different organizations that sort of represent the blockchain as a whole. So the Digital Chamber of Commerce and the GBBC, the Global Blockchain Business Council. And I think both those things are necessary, right? Like we act individually and talk to people individually, and then we act as part of a collective and talk to people as part of that collective. From my perspective, I think it's more is more, right? Like everyone should be out there trying to talk to these, like any foundation should be out there trying to talk to policymakers, and then we should also all be getting together to talk to policymakers, and so that we're doing both.
Yeah, that's great, and it's great to that you're kind of taking a visible and active role in those things, on behalf of the foundation, because I think it is definitely something that isn't automatic, and I think the thing that is interesting is to understand kind of how different jurisdictions and governments reason about this phenomena, and I think it's it, there it, right now it hasn't. It doesn't feel like it's been sorted out.
Right. There is still a lot to figure out, and there's just like a lot of uncertainty, and that regulatory uncertainty, I think, weighs on everyone in the industry. And I can also tell that there's a huge appetite to actually get out there and sort of engage with legislators, right? When the self-hosted wallets rule was proposed over Christmas, there was an open comment period, and I think they got more comments to that proposed regulation than maybe anything else that they'd posted recently, right? There were thousands and thousands of people writing in, and I read through a lot of those comments and even helped work on the one that SDF submitted, and they were well reasoned, they were deep, they were really, really thoughtful, and it was kind of an amazing moment to say, okay, the industry as a whole is ready to try to help craft these meaningful regulations. And I think when we do, it will start to dispel that fog of uncertainty, and it will honestly make everything a lot easier.
That's great. I definitely personally made some comments on that proposal, and I do think that it's a the timing of it was a little strange, and it was definitely seemed to be in a hurry, right? So I think it's quite a contrast to things like the Bitcoin ETF. So if you look at what goes slow and what goes fast and why in Washington, it's always an interesting thing to contemplate.
I can see what goes slow and what goes fast. I usually can't see why.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. The whys are really opaque, and it's really interesting. It's interesting from a political perspective. So, I guess for me, in terms of this year, like what are the kind of plans, roadmap, what's ahead for this year in Stellar? Do you have like specific things that you guys are communicating to community about?
Yeah, we have also a publicly posted roadmap, which you can also just check out. I don't know the URL for that one off the top of my head, but you can just Google it. But on our roadmap, there's sort of the growing of the ecosystem, right? And specifically trying to get more and more of these anchors on board. So the goal is to continue to connect local currencies to the network so that people can get on and off. so that they can, once they're on, transact with all the other network assets on the network. So growing the anchor network is always a top priority for us. It has been over, really, since the inception of Stellar, and it continues to be. We've seen a lot of progress, but we'll continue to see a lot more this year. And there's a lot of stuff in the pipeline, right? So there's more assets that are going to be launching over the course of the year. On the technological side, you know, as I mentioned, Stellar has built-in decentralized exchange, right? So you can easily convert one asset to another. And as you can probably imagine, one of the big challenges there is the creation of liquidity, right? Because in order to effectively transmute those assets, you need to be able to have order books that are full, so that you can take advantage of those offers and the little slippage to be able to, like, sort of convert at good rates.
Yeah.
And so one of the sort of technologically, if you look at our roadmap, you'll see that there's a lot going on inside of SDF to try to figure out better ways to bring liquidity to Stellar. There's also a lot going on in the ecosystem, some ideas for how to start to do things that increase liquidity on the network. So more anchors, better liquidity. And then finally, we're also, you know, like many blockchain networks, there's always this question of throughput. Stellar has good throughput. It's better than, it's higher, I guess I'll say, I don't want to say better, but it's higher than a lot of other networks. At the same time, we also have been, after talking with the ecosystem, realized that there's a lot that needs to happen to enable Stellar to sort of connect to sidechains or layer two solutions, essentially, so that we can improve scalability and improve throughput. And so I think we'll also start to see those kinds of things. So Stellar related layer two solutions. So anchors, liquidity, layer two.
Wow, that's a great and ambitious roadmap. I mean, I think layer two is a logical thing, right? Because if you look at something like credit cards, you know, a credit card is basically like a payment channel, right? In the sense that, you know, what you've established is a pre-designated relationship outside of the settlement layer, right? And so, you know, effectively settlement will happen later, right? So there's finality and settlement, but, you know, ultimately credit cards are just sitting, you know. So in a sense, like, I think layer twos are kind of an emergent property of transactional finance, you know, on a fabric. So I think that that's a very logical set of steps. In terms of kind of things like access, I think you mentioned an Argentinian project, you know, on the front end. You know, are there any geographies of the particular interest or note, or, you know, do you have a specific, you know, obviously country pairs do matter quite a bit, but, you know, I'm interested to get your global perspective.
Right. It's sort of a twofold question, because I think on the one hand, there's, again, companies that find Stellar useful can be anywhere, right? So oftentimes it's kind of up to the consumer of Stellar, which is some business that's going to build on it, as to whether or not Stellar is a good fit for their particular market, or whether there's a corridor that they can set up that takes advantage of the Stellar network. Like I said, we're growing that anchor network, that network of on-off ramps. And as of right now, there's, you know, there's a lot of activity in Latin America, and there's a lot of activity in Africa. As well as in, you know, especially connecting to Europe and to the United States. So those, I would say, like, as of right now, today, those are sort of two super active regions of the world where a lot of people are building on Stellar. But we're also starting to see a lot of interest in, you know, in Asia is starting to happen. But I think that that's something that will be, like, later this year. There'll be more sort of, like, activity in Asia, more Asian on-off ramps. But for right now, it's mostly Africa and Latin America, South America.
Yeah, interesting. And, you know, I think one of the things I'm kind of curious to get your perspective on, too, are, you know, I think that when you talk about, you know, providing liquidity for a decentralized exchange, you're sort of right at the cusp of sort of entering into some of the decentralized finance types of domains. You know, obviously, the thing that becomes interesting is, you know, how you implement those types of thing. So I guess for me, I'm wondering, you know, with things like NFTs, you talked about kind of the ease of issuance of assets. So I guess I'm trying to plumb the depths of kind of appropriate extensions and use cases, you know, beyond just the remittance use case. And obviously, there may be remittance adjacencies, for example, things like electronic commerce or online digital information access, subscription services, right? So there may be things that are not just, you know, effectively a peer-to-peer international electronic type of cash. So I'm wondering if you see kind of adjacencies or edge cases emerging that you know will make sense for you.
Yeah. So outside of the organization, the SDF is very mission driven. So we do tend to focus on these payments cases. It makes sense. They directly relate to our mission. Well, like I said, anyone can build on Stellar, and there's a huge ecosystem of projects that take advantage of its fast settlement time and its sort of developer friendliness to create projects that are beyond sort of the scope of the SDF. NFTs is an interesting one. There's a ton of interest in NFTs right now, and I don't know how long it will persist. I'm sure it will, to some degree, people will be interested in NFTs for a long time. We could be at peak interest now, maybe not, I don't know. But I will say that like Stellar has advantages over Ethereum, which is where most NFTs are issued, obviously. Insofar as it's not as expensive to or difficult to issue an NFT, and the environmental impact of transacting is a lot lower. And so while there are challenges to issuing NFTs on Stellar, there are also people who are really sitting down and trying to figure out the best ways to do it. And there are a fair number of NFTs that have already been issued. The biggest issuer of NFTs right now, or the one that I'm most familiar with on Stellar, is a company called Lightmint. And they've been, I don't know when they issued their first one, but they have done a lot of great work, not only issuing NFTs, but explaining how you do it and explaining why you do it and explaining how it works on Stellar, the technical details. So you can just go to Lightmint and they will walk you through the process of creating one. And they're also about to launch a marketplace. So, you know, it's a technology that makes sense to bring to Stellar. As of right now, it does not have the sort of broad, there aren't as many people doing it on Stellar yet. But I think that's going to change over the next few months. But I don't know. I'd say in the past like 2 weeks, I don't know how many people from outside of blockchain life, just like artists, musicians, that I know from before, who are calling me up to ask me how you do this. And so I think there is a good answer. I think the best place to look for it is Lightmint. And I think it is a use case that will continue to grow on Stellar NFTs.
Yeah, I appreciate the perspective. You know, I think that it absolutely is a very hot topic at the moment. You know, and I think that these types of waves, you know, they sort of do come and go. It's a very interesting thing to try to contemplate. But, you know, one of the things you mentioned, obviously, is the music industry, you know, and I think that we do kind of have to try to absorb the logical implications broadly about the, you know, blockchain and its available use cases. You know, I do think that, you know, the primary use case in my mind for early adoption is financial infrastructure. So obviously things like monetary instruments, you know, which I think Stellar has optimization for, and then other things like equity-like instruments, tokens, you know, and so these are digital native assets, you know, obviously Bitcoin being an important native asset. But I think, you know, if you look at the value of all financial assets, the next logical thing would be the value of all intellectual properties, right? So, you know, in a sense, the idea of the potential to digitize intellectual property and to enable it to be regulated for usage becomes, I think, a logical next step for blockchain technology. So, you know, I think that's what makes it, I think, worth experimenting with.
Yeah, and there are huge advantages, obviously, to blockchain and to proof of ownership and to immutability, to traceability and to transparency that lend themselves, those advantages lend themselves well to tracking intellectual property, right? The question that I find myself answering to a lot of people that I've been talking to who don't know much about blockchain is like, but it's obviously very hard to actually store a large amount, to have each unit, you know, store a large amount of information, because a blockchain is also a distributed ledger. So anytime you store something on it, you're not just storing it on a local database. You're saying, everyone who stores this database, please store this information forever.
Yes.
Right? And so this, like, you know, blockchain is not ideally suited for arbitrary storage of super large data files forever, because there is actually a cost to the infrastructure. And so it's really like, what's interesting to me is like, you know, and which is why blockchains are storing like hash values. They're storing super compressed representations of data. And so it's interesting to me to try to like unpack, especially for someone who's not super familiar with blockchain, like the relationship between, say, a song and some hash that represents an NFT ownership of that song. And I think there's still like some work to figure out how these things connect and how they connect in a way that's intuitive enough to explain to the world at large.
Yeah, and I think we will, I think it will be different on a per media basis. So I think that, you know, we have music, we have books, we have visual art, movies, and, you know, there's 3D representations, VR. So there's so many different, you know, many I haven't even mentioned. So, you know, I think, you know, we will have to come up with different systems, you know, obviously things like software licenses, that's extremely distinct and unique. So, you know, mm-hmm. I think we're going to see a pretty interesting future in the space. Any final thoughts?
I mean, I think that the most interesting thing to me about blockchain is just that there's still so much innovation going on, which is kind of what we were just talking about, right? There are all of these ideas, there's all these places where it could be applied. And beyond financial instruments, there's a question of how does it impact the rest of the world? And I think what's really cool and fun about where we are right now is just trying to figure all that stuff out. It's a great time for innovation. Yeah, thanks for having me. This was great.